Hello, everyone. Happy Tuesday evening. It's good to be here with you. Seems like everybody's a little early tonight. Maybe that's a misperception on my part, but it seems like that sometimes when I begin, people aren't here, but as I play the song, they're popping in. And you guys were here tonight a little early listening to what do you guys call it? Growing with NTI with Jacqueline and Connie. And that's great. That was a lot of fun seeing everybody in the room early. I am still going to play a song. We may still have some others join us. And the song that I picked out is a Kirtana song from her album, A Deeper Surrender. It's called Do You Hear the Music? And it kind of jumped out at me because we're shifting, sort of, and not sort of. We're shifting from lessons to review. And I feel like every time we shift from lessons to review, and also when we shift from review to lessons, I feel like each time it's really a call for a deeper surrender, right? Like each time, okay, now let's go a little deeper. Now let's go a little deeper. So we're in that shift. So that's what attracted me. It's funny, the album name really attracted me, but I think the song will fit as well. Again, the name of the song is Do You Hear the Music? And this is by Kirtana. Maybe you don't need to understand.
listen to the music in your heart. In your heart.
Nice song about surrender. I like that. So just a kind of an announcement. It's more of a, I don't know, just information in advance. Currently we are working on a new website. You guys may have heard something about this in July. I think we announced it at one of the weekly gatherings. I think we're now probably only about 3 weeks away, 3.5 at most, from making that website live. And one of the things we've done as we designed the new website is we designed it with the Gentle Healing Group in mind. So when we get the new website, it's going to be a lot easier for you to find the homework, find the tips, find the Gentle Healing playlist, find the daily contemplation. So when we get that new website, maybe I'll kind of unroll it during a gentle healing meeting and show you guys where everything is at. It's also going to work a lot better on your phones than the current website. So in a way, we've been working on this for many months. And Lynn is asking, is Regina skipping? How's my sound with everybody else? I assure you I'm sitting still. I'm not skipping. Yeah. So I'll let you know when the website's ready. Of course, you'll see it. If you just log on one day and suddenly it's dramatically different, don't get scared. You didn't go to a malware site or anything like that. One day it's going to be turned on. And I'm not even sure how much notice I'll have when it comes time to turn it on. It might seem pretty sudden. We'll see what happens, see how it plays out. But it should be within the next 3 to 3.5 weeks. So now we're at the place where you all get to share. You can share based on these last 6 workbook lessons that we did, workbook lessons 195 to 200. You can also share based on NTI John 15 to 21. You can share based on the Byron Katie video or just based on your own looking and your own experience, your own self-inquiry, your own clarity that's popping, all of that. Anything that's coming as a part of the gentle healing experience, you can share here. So who would like to open up the sharing time? All right, Sherry, the mic is yours.
Just a quick check. Okay, cute. I will say first off that I'm only going to be in class for a little bit. We've got a commitment to go to a little bit later, so I'll be checking out early. But I wanted to share briefly about my my experience with the Byron Katie video. Basically, I felt like I kept getting jumbled up in the questions. It seemed like my response to each of the questions was basically the same thing for each question, and that resulted in my feeling a lot of resistance to doing her work. But there was a comment that she had toward the end that was something like, "What would you be without that thought?" And that comment did hit home, and I was able to use it in the practice this week. So how I used it, how it came up, was that I'm out of town this week at my boyfriend's house. He lives in Chicago, and I live in Arkansas. So I've been working remotely from home, from his home. He came in yesterday at lunch to change clothes to work out, and at the time I was on a business phone call, So he didn't say anything to me when he came in. He just got his clothes together and went to do his workout. And when he came back, I was kind of in a huff because he hadn't spoken to me. He went on back to work, and what I did was I practiced my homework on that incident, on me feeling huffy about the little lunch exchange, or lack of exchange. So basically my answer to each of the questions was that he should have acknowledged me, he was wrong and insensitive for not speaking to me, that kind of stuff. In truth, I felt a little embarrassed about the upset. It seemed so kind of trite, so kind of yesterday's complaints in comparison to what I, quote, should be working on with my spiritual practices. When I came to the piece about what would I be without the thought that he was insensitive and wrong, without the thought that he should have done certain things, what I saw was that without that thought, I was just peaceful girl sitting in a peaceful room taking care of my work tasks.
Right.
And I asked, what would I be without even the thought that I was a girl taking care of tasks? What I saw was just peacefulness itself, sitting in a room of peacefulness. And that the peacefulness couldn't be contained by the room and couldn't be contained in the girl. That I was just peace itself in peace itself. And that reminded me of awareness watching awareness. Hmm. I hadn't been what I considered especially, quote, successful with awareness watching awareness meditation. I'm often distracted when I attempt it, and I felt like I wasn't doing it correctly because I think I had this preconceived notion that I was supposed to have a certain experience with it and that I just didn't get it. But somehow, through the practice of the questions with the work, and especially with that question of what would I be without the thought, that seemed to drop me right into the lap of awareness watching awareness. So I just love that so many of the practices that we've been working with over the past months, self-inquiry, root cause inquiry, now the work and awareness watching awareness, they all seem to come together in a sweetness of combination of practices this past week. So thank you, and I'll pass the mic.
Yeah, thank you very much for sharing. Thank you very much for using what we're learning here to look at what's happening within your life. That's really the purpose, and I appreciate the demonstration. And Stephen, the mic is yours.
Thanks, Regina. And, do I have the mic? Geez, I'm having a tough time getting the mic locked. Let me. Am I on? Okay. Geez, I'm sorry. Hey, thanks for the talk about Byron Katie. I wanted to talk about her video too. I'm familiar with her process and have seen her several times in person, and it's, her four questions have been very helpful to me. What I got out of it was, maybe this is just my judgment too. I didn't have any resistance to her questions and how they go out, but the people that she talked to, particularly the guy that talked about being abandoned, and actually a couple other people too, I saw the process on how they looked at the underlying beliefs that people should do what they wanted to do and whatnot. But what I got was, from that video, that their beliefs changed, or that their underlying reasons for being upset actually changed, even though they saw what Byron was able to show them through the process. Geez, I'm not being very clear here. So what I got was how powerful our beliefs can be in a way that I hadn't seen before, that despite seeing that they can be untrue, and what really hit me was that guy that talks about abandonment, at the very end, my sense was he still believed in abandonment, that he could be abandoned. And I think Byron Katie is, of course, extremely skillful and helpful to many, many people, including me. When I saw, in my opinion, that people's beliefs really didn't change even through a process, maybe because it was so short. Byron put a crack in their armor. I sure agree with that. And anyway, so long story short, how it helped me, that video, was that I believe that some of the beliefs I hold that aren't true, as I discover them, it's not as easy it seems sometimes to get rid of them. Even the root cause, which I wrote on a couple of things, and I'd have to say I still have them. So there's probably going to be some repetition in investigating some of the beliefs that I hold that aren't serving me well, which involves work. Hey, I keep forgetting too, Byron Katie mentioned somewhere in that video, that's why she calls it the work. But at any rate, it was a great video, and that's how it was helpful to me, to see that despite uncovering some false beliefs, there's more to it than that. Oh, and Nancy's here. Hi, Nancy. Okay, sorry, I'll give up the mic.
Yeah, thank you. You commented that maybe because there wasn't enough time, and I think that that's a true statement. She made a comment during the video that she didn't have much time. I think she was at a bigger conference, and like her time on stage was an hour or something like that, and her job was to give people who probably didn't know about the work a taste of the work in about an hour. And that's why I picked that particular video, was for that same purpose, to give people a taste of the work in about an hour. You know, so that was her purpose, and that's what I wanted to do as well. And the reason I'm introducing you to the work is just because it's another type of self-inquiry. You know, obviously root cause inquiry is the one that was kind of born in me and the one that I used, and it's the first one that I've taught you. And some people take to root cause inquiry really well. I think Stephen and Nancy maybe have taken to it really well, along with their friend Myron. But other people, they just don't get it. And so I don't want to give just one option for self-inquiry, because it's the inquiry itself that's so important. So Byron Katie is another really strong option that I wanted to share. And just in case you didn't quite get the four questions, because this wasn't like a formatted lecture, she more demonstrated the questions than laid them out on a chalkboard. So the first of all, obviously you look at what you were thinking and feeling in the moment, right? And she was very, very clear about that. But then the four questions are, is that true? And she always follows that with, can you be absolutely certain that it's true? The second question is, who would you be without that thought? The third question is the turn it around. People often have a bit of a challenge with the turn it around. I think I might have missed a question. Oh, yes, I did. I missed the second question. So the first question is that true? The second question is, how do you react when you think that thought? Right? How do you feel? How do you react when you think that thought? The third question is, who would you be without that thought? And then the fourth question is the turnaround. And I'm going to talk a little bit more about that when it's my turn to share. Also, just as an FYI, in a couple of weeks, we're going to return to Byron Katie as a part of our homework. But we're going to do it in a different way. I'm going to point you to a YouTube list that has dozens upon dozens, if not hundreds, of Byron Katie audios. And what I'll let you do is kind of scan through and pick the one you want to listen to, one that maybe hits kind of close to home for you. There's, you know, all kinds of things that she's helped people with. So we'll get a chance to listen to the work again. Who else would like to share about this past week or from this past week? All right, Lynn, the mic is yours. And welcome home, by the way.
Oh, I had mic trouble, too. I hope you can hear this. Can you hear me? Okay. That question from Byron Katie really helped more than the turnaround. And then I did find another video that was like 2 hours long, but I didn't have a chance to finish watching. Yeah, for that, T.I. John, chapter 18. In there it says, I am that which you seek. I am you. I am that you seek, and I am you. I had a lot of resistance to that. And then I love the way it just... then went right into, do not pull away from the idea. Accept this idea as it is presented, fully without question, and you accept heaven as your reality. So then I just started inquiring, why do I resist this idea? And it says, you will feel unworthy and guilty. You do not believe the greatness of the light within. Stop seesaw. Out only the truth, because I tend to seesaw back and forth. So I said, why do I feel unworthy? It's a deep-rooted belief that needs to be released along with the guilt. And I said, how is it all released? And the answer was, by your constant willingness to ignore your own thoughts and allow the light. Give up the beliefs that do not serve you. Stay in gratitude and accept all things as neutral. Just lessons God would have you learn. You can learn without suffering and pain. That lesson, Regina, is really sticking with me. Release your doubt and your denial. Stand in peace, silent and willing, and be steadfast in the desire of your heart. So then I just wrote in my journal, I make the choice to listen to the voice of truth. So then jump forward to today's lesson, lesson 200 in A Course in Miracles. There is no peace. Accept the peace, and I am glad and thankful it is so. And the lesson says, for peace is union, if it be of God. And that word union just kept coming to me. And I looked it up, and it said, union is the act of uniting two or more things into one. It's a state of being, so united, it's a junction. And the Course says, peace is already recognized at last. And you can feel its soft embrace surround your heart and mind with comfort and with love. So this is wrote from my heart. God's peace is with us. It is here. Open your eyes and feel it. You know the peace of God. You have felt it in meditation and in the quietness. Now realize that is union with God. That is God's embrace. It has been there the whole time, but you realize it not. You cross the bridge to leave this world behind. You felt the peace of God. Understand why we meditate. We meditate to find that peace and union with God. Now, do you understand? And I had a chuckle. Even if you don't have visions, peace is the purpose. That peace beyond understanding is a union with God's peace and love. You fall into God's arms. It is His embrace. It is the love and comfort you believe in meditation, and that is the grace.
And then lesson 200 says, seek no further than the peace of God, for peace is union if it be with God, of God. We are close to home and draw even closer as we say, there is no peace except the peace of God, and I am glad and thankful it is so. So with gratitude, I am so glad. So here's the mic.
Yeah, thank you very much, Lynn. And there's always something in me that wants to cry. It's that happy, grateful cry. Whenever I hear anyone sharing from their inner self, from having gone in and asked questions and received answers, I just am so dang touched by that. Every time one of you guys do that, I just cannot tell you how happy that makes me. So thank you, Lynn, for doing that, and also thank you for sharing that. All right, who else would like to share? Ken, the mic is yours.
This morning, we were listening to the Byron Katie video. And so I was going through the exercise with it and thinking of a moment where I was upset doing all the different things. And I found my body tensing up. And so I would relax. And as each person was sharing, I found my body tensing up again. And I would then relax. And every time somebody shared, and especially when it was the two women that were questioning about being violated, that I really tensed up strong. But the further she got into the questions and the further I went down the rabbit hole of where she was taking everybody, I kept finding my body tensing up, and it became so emotionally strong for me that I had to pause the video a number of times to regroup. I found it to be one of the most powerful experiences that I have had in the various types of self-inquiry and the insights that she would bring up of not saying anything new to me, but giving me a different way of looking at things, of especially when she was talking about being hit and how that in the next moment stated that she was no longer being hit. But if we get stuck in the pain of being hit, we relive being hit over and over and over and over as if we were still being hit. And that was such a great metaphor for me of when I get stuck in the memory of what I deem a violation, a hurt, a wrong, that I am just stuck in that loop of reliving that moment. Even though it's past, it's done, it's over, the pain is no longer there, but I continue to relive it. And that was great motivation for me to really looking at those memories as being, yes, Kathy, it can't be myself that I crucify. And that's what it so felt like, is I, in that moment of reliving that memory that I was using as the exercise, that I was crucified. I found it to be, and I know Becky has told me that it is very powerful for her. She's gone through times And I really thank you again, Regina, for assigning it. Letting go of the mic.
Yeah, thank you, Ken. I really enjoy, you know, Byron. We play, you know, a fair amount of Byron Katie videos on Awakening Together Radio, and I really enjoy every single one of them that I've ever heard. I mean, she can take people with, you know, what seems like impossible situations to see different, and of course they can struggle quite a bit in the beginning, but she can really, really help people see differently. She's a master at that. So thank you. Who else would like to share? All right, maybe it's my turn to jump in and start with the sharing then. But if someone else feels to share along the way, we still have 15 minutes. So you guys have 15 minutes credit, which means someone else can share if they feel to along the way. How's that sound? all right, Catherine. All right, so I wanted to share from the some things that I noticed as I was watching the Byron Katie video. Now, of course, I was already familiar with the work. So what jumped out at me wasn't so much the work as some of the apply, whether you're doing the work or whether you're doing another type of self-inquiry. One of the things that I noticed is she was helping people in filling out the worksheet, which we didn't see. I think if I remember correctly, Lynn posted a link to the worksheet in Sharing and Contemplation Together. But we didn't see the worksheet in the video. But she was using the worksheet to help people look right at the situation, what they felt, and what they thought with complete honesty and no false spirituality. I remember when I used to journal on my upsets in the day, one of the things that I was guided to do was be drastically honest. You know, like, I remember one thing in particular where I was writing about one person, and I think I wrote something like, I don't like him. And the spirit in my mind said that was too gentle. That I was avoiding looking at what I really felt and asked me to look again. So I closed my eyes. Remember, she said meditate on the situation. I kind of did that. I closed my eyes. I looked back at the exact situation that I was looking at in my journal, and I felt it again, and I found myself writing, he disgusts me. And that felt honest. Like that was honestly the feeling in the situation. And so one of the things we want to do when we are looking at situations in order to heal them is we want to be drastically honest. And what we're being drastically honest about here is the ego's point of view, right? But we want to capture that point of view completely. Because if we let ourselves get away with things like, I don't like him, when that's just too soft, what we're doing is we're not digging deep enough. We're not looking deep enough. So whether you use the work or root cause inquiry or some other way of looking, don't be afraid to be so honest that when you're finished writing, you're going to have to tear the paper up in 1,000 pieces away and pieces of paper and throw it away. If you go back and read my journal, you are going to find things like, I hate my daughter. Because there were moments when that's how I felt. And, so that authentic honesty, again, it's about the ego point of view, but it's very, very helpful to look right at that. And so that's one of the things she was leading people to do. And the funny thing is, the longer someone has been on a spiritual path sometimes, Yeah, that's what I'm about to say too, Sharon. That's right where I'm going. I'm going to say the longer that that you've been on a spiritual path, sometimes the harder it is to be honest. Isn't that funny? Because you bring out the spiritual, you know, the spiritual. Instead of saying he disgusts me, you say, oh, I was just projecting on him that day, or or something stupid like that. And it's stupid because it's avoiding really looking, right? And so don't be spiritual. If you're upset, then go in and look at your upset. Look at that part of your mind. And that's the first step. Yeah, get to the real feeling. Yeah, that's how you're going to heal. You got to get right down in it. So that was the first thing she was leading people to do. And again, she told them to stay in that moment, right? The moment that they were looking at, to stay in that moment. You know, it may have happened 20 years ago, and there may be a part of you that says, in fact, she said this, a part of you that says, oh, but I'm okay with that now. But that's not true. If that's not true, if that was true, when she asked the question, please remember, you know, something that upsets you, that wouldn't have came to mind. So if it came to mind, it's still in there, and you haven't let go of that, right? So make sure you go back to that moment, stay in that moment, look right at that moment, look right at what you were feeling, what you were thinking, and you know, if it's me, I would write all of that down. Of course, that's what a worksheet basically has you do, right? Is write all of that down. I would write all of that down in the journal. And just be as honest as I could be. Another thing that she pointed out, which I think is critically important, and if everybody got this, the world would be so different. Another thing she pointed out was anything that we are upset about or afraid of is just an image in our head. It's just imagination. And in fact, even if you brought up a thought, a situation, as you were watching the video, you know, which I think is really what would have been the best way to watch the video, to go through it with your own situation in your mind, right? When you brought up that situation, where was that situation? It was in the mind. It may have been what you would call a memory. You know, you might say it really happened, but it's not happening now. So it's an image, it's imagination. And certainly anything about the future, you know, any fears we have about the future are just imagination. And I would say when I was kind of growing up with Spirit and writing with Spirit every day, that's one thing Spirit emphasized on me over and over and over again. And it took a long, long time for me to get it. That it was imagination. You know, I'm one of those people that would say, no, it really happened. He really said that. It doesn't even matter if it really happened, if he really said that. Right now, while I'm upset about it, you know, a week later, a month later, 5 minutes later, it's imagination. It's, you know, it's like she said to that one young man who was feeling abandoned, you know, it's 3 weeks later and you're still in that bedroom on the phone. Right? It's imagination. And if we could really, really get just that one point, that all of this stuff that we're carrying around or fearing about the future is just imagination, we could be free in a moment by just dropping our imagination, by not holding to these images in the mind. In fact, one of the questions she asked a few times in the video is, what's real? You know, what's real? You now or that image in your mind? You now, as you are right now. Or that image in your mind, which one is real, right? And in fact, one of the things she said in the video is that the work, the purpose of the work is actually even to go beyond letting go of false beliefs like abandonment. The purpose of the work is to lose your identity. And one of the things she pointed out is that your identity is actually in those images that you hold in your mind. Your identity is in the images of your story from the past and your dreams or your imagination about the future. And so as we let go of those images in our mind, we're also letting go of our false identity. I loved when she first started talking to the man who thought that he was abandoned. And, you know, she asked, "Where were you?" And he said, "I was in the bedroom, you know, on the bed, talking on the phone." And she asked the audience, she said, "Okay, can you see him there?" And I guess, you know, I assume the audience was shaking their head. Yeah, they could all see him. And she goes, "Okay, if we have 2,500 people here, we have 25 different hymns and 2,500 different bedrooms." And, you know, people don't realize that. You know, that when we listen from such an individual point of view. And, you know, and we add our imagination to whatever we are hearing. We think that the way we are hearing is the truth, when actually it's just our perspective. I remember once Kathy Smith and I got busted. I don't know if Kathy remembers this, but I said something and Kathy said something. And I don't know if she got her comment from me or if she came up with it all by herself. You know, Michael Langford told a story about when he used to go listen to Krishnamurti and how everyone else would, you came up with it all by yourself, okay, and how everyone else would leave and he would stay and contemplate. And I told that story once when I was teaching, and Kathy told that story once when she was teaching, and I think we both mentioned that Michael would be the only one left in the auditorium or something like that. So Michael emailed us, and he said there was no auditorium. We were outside. Oh, yeah, Kathy said the only one left in the room. I said the only one left in the auditorium. And he let us know. And I thought that was perfect that he let us know that we were making stuff up. I mean, it didn't really change the moral of the story. The moral of the story was correct, right? Yeah, he sent us a video so we could see right where it was. It was outside amongst the trees. But do you see, in a grove, yes, in a grove. But do you see how Kathy and I added our own imagination to what we heard and never questioned it? And again, that was a minor little thing. The only thing is, that's what we all do all the time. And so we have these individual worlds existing in our heads. And in fact, that's one thing that is great about the first question in the work. Is it true? And can you be absolutely certain that it's true? I can't be absolutely certain anything that I remember is true. I have had enough times in my life where I thought I was absolutely certain. And I sat down with somebody else who was there too. And they had a completely different memory. I've heard Dove come in here and tell stories about when he and I first met and how that happened. And although the gist of how Dove tells the story is similar to the gist of how I remember it, I have different specifics. If I was to tell the story about how we met and he was to tell the story about how I met, there's going to be differences. And neither, I'm sure neither Dove nor I are consciously making things up, right? We're both telling the story the way we think it happened. That's just the way the mind is. It makes stuff up all the time. It adds an auditorium where there is none. and we don't even know that we're believing fantasies. And so that very first question, is it true? Are you absolutely certain it's true? You know, if we have enough experience, we find, no, I actually can't be absolutely certain of anything my mind remembers. It twists and changes things and rearranges the facts. And no, I can't be absolutely certain. This is the way I remember it. This is the way it's in my mind now. I can say that. This is the way it's in my mind now. But can I be absolutely certain that's the way it happened? Can I be absolutely certain that other people perceive the same thing I perceived? No. Because really, mind is imagination. And it's adding to things all the time, and we're not even noticing it. So Lynn says, so Regina, as we talk about the imagination of our own mind, I struggle with believing my guidance. Can you say something to explain difference? Is it really helpful to hear? It is really helpful to hear your comments on the inquiry. Okay. Guidance is not the same as memories or images in the mind or imagination. Guidance is helping you to look at your imagination and let it go. That's probably the primary difference. Imagination isn't helping you to let go of your imagination. Imagination builds on it. Guidance is helping you to look at it and let it go. Loving guidance is really helping you see that you're wrong. That you're wrong about who you are. You're wrong about what you believe. You're wrong about your point of view. You know, I remember once a friend, and this friend said this many, many times. Many, many times she would say, Holy Spirit will never tell you that you're wrong. And I remember every time she'd say that, I'd think, oh my gosh, that's all Holy Spirit does is tell me that I'm wrong. In a loving, non-judgmental way. But it's not adding to your imagination. It's pointing out that that's imagination. And so because the perspective and the goal of the Holy Spirit is completely different, that's how you know it's not imagination. I told a friend the other day, and Ken Wapnick used to say this all the time too, you are always channeling, is the way Ken Wapnick would word it. You're always channeling either the ego or the Holy Spirit. Or we could say either the wrong mind or the right mind. There's no in-between mind. Mind is either right mind perspective or wrong mind perspective. There isn't this in-between mind. And I think that we often imagine there's this in-between mind that we can call me. I'm the in-between mind. And then I have an ego and I have, a right mind, right? Or I have an ego and I can hear right mind. I might not even think I have a right mind. I can hear right mind. I can listen to Holy Spirit. But that in between that we imagine that we're standing in doesn't actually exist. Every single solitary thought is either ego or right mind. It's coming from the ego perspective or the right mind perspective. There isn't an in between land. And so you can judge or discern based on the purpose, whether it's coming from the ego or whether it's coming from the right mind. And yeah, and there is no middle. It's one or the other. So you can judge by the perspective, by the purpose, which one it is. And again, the ego doesn't come in and help you see that your perspective is wrong. The ego is the one that says you're right. She's a B-I-T-C-H, you're right. but the Holy Spirit or the right mind comes in and says, well, let's wait a minute. Let's look at this a little different. Can you be sure? The work is the right mind. Can you be sure that it's true? You're absolutely sure that it's true. You see that inquiry, that questioning, that perspective. That's the right mind. Yeah, and Sharon says, right mind feels liberating. So yeah, I love that point. If there's 2,500 people in the audience right now, we have 2,500 different hymns and 2,500 different bedrooms. Also, there was a question. I think, this kind of got interjected in somehow because it seems to me like the question was like while the guy was walking up to stage, and maybe I just wrote it down a little bit late. While he was walking up to stage, she chatted with a couple people in the audience and one young woman in the audience was upset about a friend who didn't keep her commitments. And Byron Katie asked, how many people here have not kept commitments? And I feel pretty certain, even though I don't have a specific memory that pops up right this moment, but that's just because my mind is so bad. I feel pretty certain I've not kept commitments. Right? I mean, I may not be able to tell you a story, but yeah, I'm pretty certain I've not kept commitments. And in fact, Kathy says she, I think, oh, your hand's up. I thought you were saying you raised your hand, you hadn't kept commitments. Okay, let me finish this and I'll turn it over to you. That's another perspective that I think can be really helpful, if we can do it in a non-judgmental way, when we're looking at someone for rejecting us, and we're looking at someone for lying to us, and we're looking at someone for not keeping a commitment, when we're looking, oh, that is what you meant, okay. When we're looking at someone for whatever, I think it can be a little bit helpful, at least sometimes, a little bit softening, to say, have I ever done that? Because the ego wants to just say it's them, right? They're the bad one. You know, have I ever, you know, like maybe I'm mad at somebody for being kind of short with me. Have I ever been short with anyone? Yeah. You know, of course I have. You know, have I ever not kept a commitment? Have I ever abandoned a friend? Well, I don't know if abandoned is the right word, but I definitely remember a friend I chose to quit being friends with immediately. You know, is that abandoned? I don't know. It felt like the right decision, but from her perspective, it might have been abandoned, right? Yeah, that could be the same as the question that we saw in the course. Maybe similar to, would I accuse myself of this, right? Like, would I be as angry at myself for this same thing? That could be the same. I remember we had a discussion about that question. But sometimes if we can look in a non-judgmental way and notice, you know, I do that too. Sometimes it can soften it a little bit. And it helps sometimes during an inquiry to soften it a little bit. It allows you to look with a little more sanity. So that can sometimes be helpful. And I'm going to pause because, Kathy, I do actually see your hand up too. So I'm going to pass the mic to you.
Actually, my hand wasn't up, so I don't know what was going on there. But around the softening piece of it, asking myself that question, like, you know, do I do that sometimes too? You know, do I behave that way sometimes too? You know, am I a Krabby Patty sometimes too? You know, am I impatient sometimes too? Am I, you know, I ask myself that as I, you know, find myself being critical to maybe a family member or, you know, anybody in general. It doesn't really matter if it's a family member or not. But, you know, looking at myself and asking, as I'm criticizing them for being crabby, like, I'm never crabby. I mean, is that true? You know, I don't even have to go to, is that absolutely true? I mean, you know, I can stop with, is that true, that I'm never crabby, that I'm never, you know, never any of these things that I seem to focus on so intently in others and criticize them for, you know. So really, Byron Katie's, I mean, I can use just simply that one question out of the four, and so, and I have in so many instances, and it feels simple and clean and, you know, takes me right back to what's going on in my own mind, you know. Instead of having the focus be external to myself, it's asking myself the question and being honest with myself. Do you know that to be absolutely true, Kathy? And never has there been a time when I've been able to say yes. So yeah, it's a very, for me at least, it's a very effective, simple inquiry. Yeah, that's all I wanted to say. Thanks.
Yeah, thank you. And sometimes this software does show somebody's hand up. I'm in the new version, even when their hand is not up. But usually, for me, it's the last person who spoke. And so it's kind of funny. Right now, I still see your hand up, but there's nothing that you can do about that. So it's kind of funny how that happens. But anyway, so if you do put your hand up, Kathy, for me, your hand is stuck up. So write the word hand or something. I'll know that you want to speak. But I think also this is a part of what that last question was about, the turnaround. You know, people come in with their anger or whatever, they're feeling dejected, whatever, without seeing that they do this too. And so one way to look at it is during the turnaround. So like if I come in and I say, you know, she did not keep her commitments to me. You know, this has happened like 3 or 4 times now, and I'm just not going to be her friend anymore. You know, and, you know, Katie asked me to turn it around. You know, and one of the things I've written down on this sheet is she should keep her commitments, right? 'Cause that's one of the things. What should they do? What to make you happy? She should keep her commitments to me, right? Well, then turn that around, Katie might say, and it would be, I should keep my commitments to me, you know? I should keep my commitments to her is another possible turnaround. You know, she does keep her commitments is another possible turnaround. And, you know, sometimes people say, well, what's the value of the turnaround? Well, what happens is we're looking at it from a very narrow perspective when we're angry. That narrow perspective is she should keep her commitments to me. That's the only way I'm seeing it. It's a one-way road. But when I start looking at these other possibilities, like I should keep my commitments to me. You know, sometimes people go, oh, yeah, you know, I don't always, you know, like I promised myself I was going to go on a diet and I didn't. Or I promised myself I was going to meditate and I don't. Or, right, I should keep my, that's true too. Or I should keep my commitments to her. Oh, yeah, there was that one time that I told her I would do this thing and, you know, I got busy and I didn't. And what it does is it helps get rid of that one-way road, you know, that one way of thinking about it. It kind of broadens the situation. It helps look at it from different perspectives. And again, it helps soften the whole thing. It helps you see that your tight ego perspective is just not, it's not complete at the very least. You know, it's just, at the very least, it's not a complete perspective. It's a very, very narrow-minded perspective. And it could even be completely wrong, right? So that's what the turnaround is for. See, some of the other things I have that I noticed. Oh, one thing I noticed, and of course one of the questions is, after the first question, which is it true? Are you absolutely sure that it's true? Oh, Lori's hand is up. Thank you very much, Lynn. I appreciate that help. And Lori, the mic is yours.
Hi, I'm assuming you can hear me. Thanks. I've been doing a lot of the work of Byron Katie, and I do it with a couple of friends because we find that having somebody else walk you through allows you to stay with it, because I find doing on my own, I was just making assumptions what the turnaround would be and not going through the whole process. And we usually... It takes about an hour and a half, we find, just to go through one sheet. And what I found is treating it like a meditation, as Byron Katie recommends, is the things that I'm judging, I find, you know, it turns out to be something completely different than what I thought was going on. It goes a lot deeper. And just as an example, one was a friend who, you know, was always talking on her cell phone when we'd be out for lunch or whatever, and how much that annoyed me. And when I went into it deeper, I could, you know, I saw myself as a kid who didn't feel seen. And, you know, I find it often will take me back to childhood memories of just this parts of me, I guess, that want to be seen. And I just find her work really, really powerful. I guess for me to go a little bit more under the hood to see, you know, what's really going on there, so that I don't have to stay stuck in it. Anyway, that's all. Thanks.
Yeah, thank you very much, Lori. And now Lori's stuck for me. I mean, from my point of view, I see Lori's hand is up. Again, it's the new software. Somebody seems like is always stuck up there. But another type of inquiry that we might look at in upcoming weeks is the choose again process, which I know some of you are familiar with. But the choose again process, that's an important part of that. It's going back to the first time you felt this way. And when people go back to the first time they felt a certain way, it typically takes them back to a childhood memory. So we'll look at that in a few weeks as well. What I'm doing over this period of time that we're in now is I'm giving a few different self-inquiry options and a few different meditation options. You've been introduced to awareness watching awareness, but you've also been introduced to the loving consciousness method, and very soon I'll introduce you to another method. And that's, again, because different people take to different things better. And I want everybody to find the tools that work best for them. So we're just kind of sampling a few things so that you can each find what helps you the most, right? So as I was about to say, and yeah, Lynn, if you still have the old Pal Talk, it's great if you help me, you know, letting me know when people's hands are up, because I have Lori stuck now, so that's all I see. Are Byron Katie's questions on her website? Yes, yeah, she said that the work is always available for free on, I think it's thework.com. I didn't personally go and check it out, but I trust her. That's what she said. So you should be able to find it there, as well as the worksheet, I think. So again, the first question is that true? Can you be absolutely sure that that is true? The second question is, how do you react when you have that thought? And so she was asking the man who felt abandoned by his girlfriend, she was asking him, how do you react when you have the thought, she abandoned me? And she had to ask him that question about 3 times. Because instead of answering the question, how do you react when you have the thought she abandoned me, he kept going to the story. He kept telling her, you know, what happened or how they met or whatever. And she kept saying, you're not answering the question. And I have noticed when I'm working with people in root cause inquiry that people have that same tendency. That tendency to go back to the story and just tell the story again instead of answering the question. Well, what were you feeling? Why did you feel that way? And I am pretty certain this is an ego defense mechanism. So I wanted just to bring it to your attention, just highlight it. If you find yourself going back to the story and telling the story, well, she said this, and then I said this, and she did this, and blah, blah, blah. You know, when you're supposed to be answering these simple inquiry questions, whether you're doing the work or whether you're doing root cause inquiry, notice, yeah, you're evading the issue. Notice that the ego, by taking you into the story, is keeping you from going deep within and looking at yourself. Because deep within and looking at yourself is how you're going to heal, right? So pay attention to that when you keep returning to the story. Now, what I also noticed, which was quite interesting, because like I said, she asked him about 3 times, how do you react when you have that thought? And he did not answer the question. So she kind of gave up temporarily, but for a good reason, and she asked him another question. She asked him about the room that he was in. She says, first of all, where were you, you know, and he was in a bedroom. And she asked him, can you see the walls in that bedroom? And he was like, well, yeah. There's a window next to me and a picture in front of me. He answered that question directly, which proved he had the ability to answer questions directly. He didn't have to go into a story about, oh, the day I bought this house, I looked at a lot of houses with a lot of bedrooms, and the reason I picked, he just answered the question. And she did that in order to kind of tune him into the fact that he could just answer a question, that he didn't need story. But it's really interesting how he was able to answer a very neutral question, you know, what was on the walls in the room that you were in, and he was not able to answer another question, how do you react when you have the thought she abandoned me, right? So pay attention to yourself. Be aware that if you're having trouble answering these simple, simple questions, that is just an ego defense mechanism. Maybe close your eyes, become still, become willing to really look, and then look at the question again and attempt to just answer the question. How do you react or how do you feel when you have the thought? Oh, I feel, you know, kicked in the chest. I feel deflated. I feel unwanted, right? Whatever it is, it doesn't matter what it is. But tune into that instead of the story. And it's the same thing with root cause inquiry. You're tuning in to how you feel, right? Or what you were believing, not the story. Another comment, which kind of just got stuck in there, but I thought it was important enough to write down. She literally said, every woman would be perfect if you did not compare. In my notes, I wrote, every person would be perfect if you did not compare. I thought that was just worth mentioning, and even though it has nothing to do with the work, I thought it was worth mentioning again. Because whatever it is that you don't like about yourself, or that you don't like about your partner, or you don't like about your boss, if you weren't comparing to at least your imagination of something different, you wouldn't have those feelings. You know, so the perception of lack of perfection comes from comparison or judgment. Right? So I just thought that was worth mentioning. I think I've already mentioned this, but the turnaround question especially, but all of the work, one of the things the work does is it helps you to look at your thoughts from an open perspective instead of remaining glued. I think that was her word, glued, to one perspective. A second ago, I called it the one-way road, right? The glued perspective is, you know, she should keep her commitments to me, and if she doesn't, she's just not worthy of my friendship. You know, that's a glued perspective. And the purpose of the work is, you know, to come in there with the inquiry and open that perspective up. At least help us see that we might not be as right as we thought we were. Right? Even that is worth something. I might not be as right about this as I thought I was. That's very, very helpful. She also talked about the difference between believing and being present. She actually called it listening, because she was talking to him about listening to his girlfriend. She said the difference between believing and listening. But I wrote down the difference between believing and being present. Because again, we don't notice how much our mind makes up. You know, like Jacqueline could be saying something to me in a meeting, and if I'm not being present and listening, my mind could be making up a story about why Jacqueline's saying that. And what I don't see is that I'm simultaneously believing my imagination, right? I'm making up a story, and then I might even turn around and tell Ken, oh, Jacqueline said such and such, but she just wanted, you know, this and that, right? So we want to learn to be present instead of believing our minds. That's where the believing happens. Learn to be present. Be alert to your mind's imagining. Be alert whenever your mind is telling you that you know someone else's thoughts. Oh, I know what she's thinking, right? that you know someone else's intentions, right? You know, be very, very alert to that, because that's imagination. That's just like when Kathy and I put Krishnamurti in a room, or in my case, an auditorium, right? We made that up. We just made it up. And that was a very neutral one. But Michael Langford, who's, you know, very on the ball, was kind enough to point that out to us. It'd be nice if we had somebody that was always pointing out to us when we made stuff up, except we might get sick of them unless we wanted to heal really quickly, because our minds make stuff up all the time. And we might get tired of hearing it. But try to be alert to when your mind is making things up. And you guys have probably heard me tell this story before. It was, it's been since I've lived here. I've lived here about 8 years, so it's been sometime in the last 8 years that I started to automatically became very, very alert to the fact that my mind was just making stuff up. And the first time I really noticed it, which is the one I remember, is when I was driving Jasmine to school one day, and there was this bus stop we would drive past every day, and you know how it is, the same kids are out there every morning. I mean, the going to school scene, everybody's in such a ritual that you pass the same cars every day, right? So we go past this bus stop where these certain kids are standing every day, and it always looks like that. And one day we drove by the bus stop, and there was a Toyota truck there. And that Toyota truck isn't usually there. and it happened to be a cold morning. And so I said to Jasmine, oh, look, they're letting their kids, I said, or maybe I didn't even say, oh, look. I just said, they're letting their kids stay in the truck until the bus arrives so they don't have to be cold. And then I thought, geez, I just made that up. I went, look at that. I just made that story up, and I almost believed it. Again, it was a very neutral story, like putting Krishnamurti in an auditorium. But it caught my attention. And after that, I started noticing my mind making things up. And at the time, this is when Danielle lived with us. It was Danielle and Jasmine and me. And I started noticing that, you know, Danielle and Jasmine both kind of looked at me as the head of the household. And so they would ask me questions a lot about things. And I would notice they would ask me questions. And my mind, I didn't know an answer, but my mind would want to make up an answer and give it to them. And so I started saying, I don't know the answer to that. And, you know, Danielle can probably tell you, I used to say that a lot once I got the hang of it. I don't know the answer to that. I don't know the answer to that. And I still say it a lot. I don't know the answer to that. You know, and I'm sure my mind still makes stuff up. It put Krishnamurti in a in an auditorium. But I certainly don't make things up to the degree I used to. I'm very willing to say, you know, I just don't know. I just don't know. But most of us don't. We make stuff up, and then we believe what we made up. We don't even notice that we made it up. You can't actually call it lying. You know, lying is when you're consciously deceiving, right? You don't even see it, right? It's so fast, you don't even see it. But start looking for it, because this is a part of the illusion that we live in, is the stuff that we're the stuff that we're making up and carrying around in our heads. And again, some of it's neutral, like, you know, putting Krishnamurti in an auditorium, but some of it isn't neutral. Like, I know why she did that, you know, and she did that, you know, to hurt me or to make me look bad or, you know, or whatever. And it's causing a lot of our own suffering and maybe even spilling out and influencing the suffering of others. And it's all made up. It's all imagination. Another point that she made, which we'll probably be looking at, you know, again in the upcoming weeks, because this point is also made in The Untethered Soul, and we're going through that book together. But another point that she really talked about is how every moment is the last moment of our lives. And on the one hand, you know, that may not appear to be true, right? But if you live each moment in that way, you know, she says, I don't want to miss any of it. Right? I don't want to miss any of it. And even, you know, that whole thought process really excites me. Just loving life itself, so much that you want to fully taste everything it brings to you. Seeing life itself as the greatest gift. I mean, can you imagine? You can't imagine. Can you imagine having never experienced life at all? Yeah, like loving your consciousness. Can you imagine? I mean, there would literally be nothing. You can't imagine it, right? Life is the greatest gift. You would never have loved for a single moment. You would never have laughed once. You would never have tasted anything that tasted good. You would never have heard any music that you enjoyed. I mean, never have seen a flower, never have heard a bird song, never have hugged your puppy, you know, or your cat. I mean, it would be nothing. So life is a grand, grand, grand gift. And then to adopt that attitude, because it's true, and to want to taste everything in life. And she talked about the man who pulled a gun on her and said that he was going to kill her, right? And she says, I didn't want to miss that connection with him. That might have been my last connection with another human ever. I didn't want to miss it. She wanted to be totally in that moment with that man who might murder her any second, because this might be her last second as Byron Katie. And, you know, it almost reminds me of loving a good book or loving a good movie, right? Loving your life in that way. It's not about what's happening. See, that's where we get messed up when we're in the ego mind. We're in the ego mind, we have this thought that I want some things to happen and there are other things I don't want to happen, right? But if you just love life itself and all of its experiences, you just love the ability to be alive and experience. Like you love a good book. I mean, all kinds of things happen in a good book, but you still love it, or in a good movie, but you still love it, right? If you can see your life in that way, then that's much more exciting. That's a much happier way to be through life. And again, Michael Singer will make that same point for us in a few weeks when we get to that chapter in his book. One thing that I thought was kind of funny, but again worth bringing up, is she had this pretend telephone conversation with the man who felt abandoned. And in the telephone conversation, she was him, and he was the girlfriend. And in this telephone conversation, she said something like, and I don't remember exactly, but it was something like, well, you know, I don't feel that way about you. I care very, very much about you, but I see that you feel differently, so you know my phone number. You can call me anytime, and I hope that we can still be friends. And the guy goes, that's exactly how the conversation went. And Byron Katie says to him, but you didn't mean it. You know, you weren't being honest when you said that. If you said to, because otherwise you wouldn't be here 3 weeks later doing the work and feeling abandoned. So I just thought that was pretty important too, to notice when we are not being honest with ourselves. I don't think it's necessary to always be what we would call honest with others. And the reason for that is I don't think people are always ready for our honesty. They can't handle the truth. And sometimes it's compassionate to be a little gentle. But are we being honest with ourselves? Right? I mean, he was lying to himself in that phone call and then quickly denied it. When he told her, well, that's okay, you know, that's how you feel, we can still be friends. You know, he wasn't being genuine at all. So, are you being genuine with yourself? Are you being honest with yourself? And again, this is a great purpose for a journal. A journal is a time that you can be honest with yourself. You don't have to tell a guy or, you know, you disgust me. In fact, the one who did, I did never tell him that. In fact, remember, Michael Singer says in The Untethered Soul, you should really never act on your ego. And if you're telling some guy you disgust me, well, then you're acting on your ego. And he says you should never do that, right? But tell yourself that that's how you feel. Tell your journal, he disgusts me. Be honest in your looking. Be honest in your inquiry. Be honest with yourself. If you can't be honest with yourself, you're not going to get anywhere. Another thing she talked about, and I don't remember the specifics of the conversation at all. It's left me completely. But this is a point I've actually been making with a friend lately, so it's kind of stood out to me. Be careful about any conditions at all that you set on life. Like if you say, I don't want to date a woman who will do that to me ever again. Or, I don't want to feel afraid. Or I don't want to feel abandoned ever again. Because any conditions that you set like that, literally the mind will use against you. If I say I don't ever want to feel afraid again, it's a guarantee that I'm going to feel afraid. If I say I don't ever want to feel abandoned again, it's a guarantee that I'm going to feel abandoned. It's just a guarantee. And so what Byron Katie was helping him to say was, I am willing to have this experience again. And that may sound a little crazy to the ego mind, but the truth is if you are willing for any experience, the openness that you have will allow you to accept the experience with a softer experience than if you said, no, I don't ever want that. When you shut down and say, I don't ever want that to happen to me, that's the one thing I will not be happy with, you have just guaranteed your unhappiness. So yeah, if I'm going to be abandoned again, I'm willing for that. It's kind of like saying, you know what? I know I can always be okay. And if you say, I know I can always be okay, what's your experience going to be? Right? So watch those conditions you put on life, because that's where you're picking your own suffering. You're hand-picking it, cherry-picking it. And in fact, she wanted him to go even further than I'm willing for. She wanted him to say, I look forward to the next time I experience abandonment. You know, to the next time I feel abandoned, right? I look forward to that. And some people may not be able to do that, but certainly they can say, I'm willing. I'm willing for whatever experience. And this is, again, when she said, I look forward to every experience that will come my way. Right? I look forward to every experience that will come my way. All right, so I think that's about it. I just want to bring up one more time that idea, because it might get forgotten, and it's really important. The chances are, when you're upset about something or when you're afraid of something, 99.9% chances are, it's just your imagination. You know, maybe when you were 12 years old, your dad did say he wished, you know, he wished you'd never been born. But you're 58 years old now, and that's just in your imagination. Right? Why are you using your own imagination to hurt yourself? So that's a very, very important point. So I just want to bring that up one more time. And that's the end of the notes that I took on the Byron Katie. I do want to say, if you would like to learn more about the work, Byron Katie does have a really good book called Loving What Is. Some of you, maybe all of you, have heard of it, Loving What Is. Also, if you're just interested in Byron Katie's perspective, how she sees and experiences life, which is very open and very freeing, another really good book is 1,000 Names for Joy. So 1,000 Names for Joy is just a bunch of really short stories about her perspective. And one thing I really liked about that book when I was reading it, I mean, each story is like 2 or 3 pages long. So I could read like one story and then go to bed pretty easily, like just read for 5 minutes and then go to bed. And I really enjoyed that when I had that book. So 1,000 Names for Joy, if you want to get to know her perspective of life, which is a very open, you know, free perspective. Or Loving What Is, if you want to learn more about the work. All right, so I'm going to transition now into the Untethered Soul. And even this is a bit of a transition, what I'm reading tonight. I'm going to read from Chapter 12. Chapter 12 is more of a, I call it a transition chapter. It's really helping you just to become more willing to face your pain. Because there's something in us, and I guess it's the ego, but there's something in us that just wants to avoid pain, right? Seek pleasure, avoid pain. And again, when we're trying to avoid pain, I remember last week we talked about the ego hides behind your pain, right? When we avoid pain, we avoid healing. The ego thrives. So this is really just kind of a willingness chapter. It's called Taking Down the Walls, Chapter 12. But the real purpose is just to help us see, again, how important it is to face our pain instead of trying to avoid it. He starts off the chapter by saying, at some point in your growth, it starts to become quieter inside. This happens quite naturally as you take a deeper seat within yourself. You then come to realize that though you have always been in there, You have been completely overwhelmed by the constant barrage of thoughts, emotions, and sensory inputs that draw on your consciousness. As you see this, it begins to dawn on you that you might actually be able to go beyond all of these disturbances. So I just wanted to read that opening because I think that's pretty positive and encouraging, right? What he does, and I don't think I'm going to read all this. I think I'm just going to tell the story myself. And I might even tell the story a little differently because I have my own version of this story that I like a little better. So I might tell it my way. I'll tell you where I changed the story a little bit so you'll know the difference between my version and his version. Let me read a paragraph before I tell the story. He says, with the understanding that thoughts, emotions, and sensory objects are simply passing before your consciousness, it becomes reasonable to question whether your sense of awareness needs to be a limited experience. What if consciousness were to remove its focus from your personal set of thoughts? And if you think about it, that's really what the work is helping you to do, right? Remove your consciousness from your very personal, very limited set of thoughts and point of view. So he says, what if consciousness were to remove its focus from your personal set of thoughts, your personal set of emotions, and your limited sensory input? Would you become untethered from the bonds of the personal self and be set free to explore beyond? And then he asked the question, how exactly did consciousness become bound to the personal self to begin with? And that's when he says the best way to explain this is to tell a story. So he goes into a story about a man who finds this lovely, lovely field somewhere with, you know, lots of light and, you know, probably gorgeous views and all of that. And the man decides to build a house there. And the man has decided that he wants solitude. He doesn't want to be disturbed. I think he's a writer. He wants to do a lot of writing. So he attempts to build a really strong house that will withstand any storms that may come. And give him complete solitude from the world so that he can write. And so he talks about how he builds this really strong foundation, and he actually builds the walls out of concrete blocks, so they're really strong. He decides to put in only the minimum amount of windows, just very few, very small windows, not a lot of windows. And then he puts shutters on the windows that can be locked tight. And, you know, he goes into all this detail how he builds this house. And in the beginning, he leaves the shutters open sometimes, but then he notices he's kind of distracted by what's going on outside. And so he decides just to keep the shutters closed and locked down all the time. In his house, he does have a basement area with a bedroom, and he has a housekeeper who lives down there, but he doesn't interact with her a lot in the beginning of the story. He's just spending all of his time alone writing. And after many, many years pass, what happens is he had these very special kinds of light bulbs, but what happens is all the light bulbs in the house begin to burn out. And he doesn't really, you know, he's been in the house so long now, he doesn't really want to leave and go out and be amongst people to buy more light bulbs. So he starts using candles to create light. And because he has a limited number of candles in the house, he only uses, you know, what he needs. He doesn't have a lot of light. One day the housekeeper that he never interacts with, she finds in the basement cases and cases of flashlights. And she tells him, and you know, and this is when she and him begin talking. And they're really excited to have found these flashlights because it's pretty dark in this house, as you can imagine, with all the shutters closed. And they begin forming a relationship around their joy of finding these flashlights. And in fact, they stage their own wedding ceremony. They get married. And this is where I'm going to change the story a little bit. He continues just with these two people, but in my story, they have a child. And their child is raised inside of this house and, of course, never goes outside. So all the child knows is, of course, its mother and father and the inside of this house and the flashlights for light. You know, the child is never seen outside. The child doesn't know anything about the lovely field that the house is built in and the sunlight. And when the child's around 13 or 14 years old, the child is, you know, just kind of pilfering around in some old books that were in a box somewhere that the father had forgotten about. And the child finds this book that talks about the sunlight, talks about the outside, and talks about how there's just this grand light that just lights up everything, you know, and the child can't even imagine it. Can't even imagine it. And as the child goes to the father and begins to ask the father, now the father by this time hasn't been outside in about 40 years himself. But he says the only way that you can ever experience that light is that you have to go outside these walls. And he's not very encouraging about going outside these walls. It's very safe in here. We have everything we need in here. You know, we have the love of our family here. We have these flashlights. You know, we have everything. There's no reason to go outside. Now, the only way I changed the story was I added the child. And the reason I added the child, the way he tells the story is the man himself finds the book. But has forgotten about the sun outside and can't really imagine it. And I don't think that's very likely. You know, I think even if the man had been in the house 40 years, he experienced the sun before he came in there, he would recall it. But a child born inside that house and raised in that house and having never experienced the sun, that's the one that would have a lot of trouble imagining it. And especially if the father is saying, we're safe in here, it's not safe out there, the child is going to be very unlikely to go outside. And Michael Singer says that's kind of what we have done to ourselves. The walls of our fortress are our psyche, our individual point of view, our way of thinking. And he says, as long as we continue to listen to our individual point of view, as long as we continue to believe our way of thinking, we stay inside that fortress with nothing but a flashlight to light our way. And we have no idea what we're missing. We have no idea about the light outside of these walls that we've built, the walls of our psyche. And he says the only way that we are ever going to know about this infinite light that is outside of the walls of our psyche is to be willing to approach and go through those walls. And the psyche is like the father in my story. The psyche is built to tell us, but we're safe in here. If you go out there, you're not safe. You're safe in here. So the psyche is built to keep us inside the fortress. That's the job we gave it, right? And now we have to be willing to approach those walls that we have built, which means approaching our own fears, approaching our own pain, and go through those walls, right, through the darkness to the light that's on the other side. Let me see some things that he says after he tells the story. Well, here's just some small sentences I've underlined. He says, our consciousness, our awareness of being is living deep inside of us in an artificially sealed off area that is absolute. It has four walls, a floor, and a roof. It is so solid that not one ray of natural light comes in. The only light we get is what we manage to create for ourselves. And, you know, creating for ourselves is whatever we do to seek pleasure. right? Seek pleasure, avoid pain. He says, your house is made of your thoughts and emotions. The walls are made of your psyche. All the concepts, views, opinions, beliefs, hopes, and dreams that you have collected around yourself. That's the walls of your house that keep you from knowing infinite consciousness. All of the concepts, views, opinions, beliefs, hopes, and dreams that you have collected around yourself. And remember, Byron Katie said the purpose of the work was to lose our identity. Our identity is the psyche, right? So the purpose of the work is to lose our attachment to the psyche. And if you really look at the work, or any type of self-inquiry, remember Tess Hughes, when we listened to her video several weeks ago, she talked about how important questioning her thinking was, right? Self-inquiry. And again, root cause inquiry is all about questioning that thinking. When we're questioning that thinking and learning to see beyond that thinking, we are tearing down those walls. Because those walls are made up of our thinking, of our individual point of view. Those are the walls. And here he says, if you want to see how restrictive your walls are, just start walking toward them. And then he gives an example. Let's say you have an emotional fear of heights. Let's say something happens that activates these old feelings of fear. I've experienced that with a few people when they've come to visit me here in Colorado, and I've taken them, you know, like maybe up Phantom Canyon Road or down, you know, which has these huge drop-offs on the side, or I take them to Royal Gorge Bridge where you walk across this bridge, but you can look down between the slits in the wood and see 1,000 feet down. I've seen people become very, very, very afraid, right? So let's imagine that situation. We're afraid of heights, and Regina is driving us, you know, down this road with this drop-off right on the side of 1,000 feet, and there's another car approaching, and we're going to have to pull over because it's like a one-lane road. Somehow we're going to have to, these two cars are going to have to pass each other on this road. These are the types of things I experience around here all the time. But, you know, some of my guests, they're terrified of this stuff. So let's imagine we're the terrified guest. So something happens. You go to visit Regina, and she drives on this road with these drop-offs, and now there's another car coming, right? It says the closer you get to your fear, the more you will have the urge to pull back. That which you collected from your past forms a boundary that you intuitively want to avoid. That's natural. That's what we do with walls. We avoid running into them. But because you avoid running into them, they lock you inside their perimeter. They become your prison because they are the boundaries of your awareness. Because you are not willing to approach them, you cannot see what is beyond them. And again, he uses the example fear of heights, but, you know, well, last week, Francine shared about her fear of her friend coming, remember, and having to drive her friend in the city, right? And remember, Francine went in and asked Holy Spirit, and Holy Spirit encouraged her to move forward with this instead of avoiding it. So Francine is moving towards her walls, right? You know, you might have a fear of speaking in the sanctuary. Maybe there's someone here who has never ever taken the mic and shared solely because they're afraid to take the mic and share. Afraid of talking in front of others, right? So they avoid talking. Avoiding talking when you're afraid to talk in front of others is staying away from your walls. If you're afraid to take the mic in the sanctuary and talk, then it's really helpful to stick your hand up and take that mic and share one day. So the more we avoid our pain and our fear, we stay locked. Kathy's saying she's not going to come visit anytime soon. We stay locked inside that fortress, our psyche. But the more we're willing to start approaching that, those walls, the edge of our psyche, we're beginning to break free from it. We're beginning to knock those walls down so that we can begin to to experience the infinite light that's outside of the walls, right? When you approach the barrier areas of your thoughts and emotions, it feels like going into an abyss. You don't want to go near that place, but you can go there. And if you want to get out, you will go there. Eventually, you will realize that darkness is not what's really there. What's really there are the walls that are blocking the infinite light. When you're looking for light, that is a crucial distinction. If you see a wall and it's protecting you from unending darkness, you will not want to go there. But if you see a wall that's blocking the light, you will want to go there in order to remove the wall. Remember in my story, I had a son. And, you know, the son read the book. He found this book about the S-U-N sun, about the sunshine. And he wanted to go outside and experience the sunshine. That curiosity, I want to experience the light, right? That made him want to go outside. But the father, representing the ego, said, oh, no, it's dangerous out there. You know, you don't want to go out there. We're safe in here. We're protected in here. And that took away the son's desire to go outside. He trusted the father, you know, trusted the ego, said, okay, I'll stay in here then. I won't go outside. So what Michael Singer is saying is, if you tell yourself that your psyche is protecting you, you know, my fear of speaking is keeping me safe. My fear of driving is keeping me safe. My fear of heights is keeping me safe. My fear of dancing is keeping me safe. My fear of whatever is keeping me safe. Then you stay locked inside. If you believe the walls are protecting you, you won't approach them. So he's saying shift your perspective. Realize what the walls are doing is they're blocking the light. If you start to see the walls as blocking the light, you'll approach them. Right? Because you don't want the light blocked. I'll read that little part again. When you approach the barrier areas of your thoughts and emotions, it feels like going into an abyss. You don't want to go near that place. But you can go there. And if you want to get out, you will go there. Eventually, you will realize that darkness is not what's really there. What is really there are the walls that are blocking the infinite light. When you're looking for light, that is a crucial distinction. If you see a wall and it is protecting you from unending darkness, you will not want to go there. But if you see a wall that is blocking the light, you will want to go there in order to remove the wall. It is often said that you must go through the darkest night in order to get to the infinite light. This is because what we call darkness is really the blockage of light. You must go past these walls. It's not really difficult to get past the walls. Time and again, every day, I love this part, listen to this. Time and again, every day, the natural flow of life collides with our walls and tries to tear them down. But time and again, we defend them. You must realize that when you defend yourself, you are really defending your walls. If something happens to challenge the walls of your psyche, you get highly defensive. Tremendous fear and turmoil can open up inside of you simply because something is not the way you thought it was. It shakes you to the core of your being because it challenges the house of thoughts in which you are dwelling. And to fix this, you start in with your rationalizations. One of the things he talks about is, you know, just as an example, you know, what if, you know, again, you're 57 years old and maybe your father died a few years ago and now your mother dies and you're going through their stuff. and you find some paperwork that says you were adopted, and you never knew this. He says what happens in that moment is your psyche, which is built up about who you think you are, what your history is and all that, your entire psyche is going to be shaken. And this is actually a time when life is showing up to knock down your walls. But what the average person will do is they will immediately begin rebuilding the walls. And he goes on in his book to say things like, well, they were nice parents. They were good to me. They love me. And just start rebuilding those walls again. And that is actually a type of defense, these rationalizations. And so, you know, we all know the type of defense. For example, you know, if I'm teaching from this book, The Untethered Soul by Michael Singer, and somebody says, oh, that book, I heard that Michael Singer guy was a complete fake. I can't believe you're believing his book. And if I feel like I want to defend my choice for this book, you know, we all know that type of defense. Right? Oh, no, you're wrong about Michael Singer. And we jump in there, right? But sometimes we miss those rationalizations. We miss those rationalizations in the mind as a type of defense. Just like we miss our imagination. We miss what we add to what we're hearing, for example. You know, like Kathy and I added an auditorium to Krishnamurti. Right? We miss our rationalizations. So it's another type of defense that you want to start paying attention to. When life is tearing down your walls, you want to learn to stand, right? In my defenselessness, my safety lies. You want to learn to stand in the open space, allow those walls to be torn down, and do not rebuild them. And, you know, there's so many ways that life can tear down your walls, right? Your spouse could leave you. You know, that's a great way when you weren't expecting it. Your spouse could leave you. You could get fired from your job. You know, what else? It's hard for me to think of examples. Maybe you guys have some examples you can type in. But when these things happen, which we often consider to be the human considers it to be the bad things in life. When these things happen, notice what's really happening is your walls are being torn down. You get cancer. That's another example. You get cancer, or someone in your family gets cancer. The death of a loved one. Yes. Right? Start learning to stay in the space that is created by these tragedies rather than rebuilding your wall with some type of rationalization. You know, when people die, I mean, I don't know about you, but I don't know what happens at death. I haven't, in my memory, experienced it. But when people die, we can make up stories about where they went, and right? Isn't that just a rationalization? I mean, do you know that for a fact, or are you making up a story about your loved one's experience, right? So that you can feel better, so you can rebuild your walls. So watch for these types of defenses. We actually want to let our walls be torn down. He says, he's talking about when we rationalize. He says, notice that you patched the cracking wall with thoughts. You patched with thoughts that which is made of thought. So your psyche is nothing but thought. Something happened in life that tore down one of the walls of your psyche. And you quickly just made it up another story so you could rebuild that wall, right? You patched it with thought. So we want to be comfortable without thinking we know everything. That's an openness. He says, you can step outside of your house of thoughts into the unlimited. Your awareness can expand to encompass vast space instead of limited space in which you dwell. True freedom is very close. It's just on the other side of your walls. Enlightenment is a very special thing, but in truth, one should not focus on it. Focus instead on the walls of your own making that are blocking the light. This is like A Course in Miracles, where it talks about seeking for the obstacles to love's presence, right? Focus instead on the walls of your own making that are blocking the light. Of what purpose is it to build walls that block the light and then strive for enlightenment? And really, you know, to say that we want to be awake or we want to be enlightened or we want to be healed and yet to continue to maintain our psyche, you know, it's working against ourselves, isn't it? Of what purpose is it to build walls that block the light and then strive for enlightenment? You can get out simply by letting everyday life take down the walls you hold around yourself. You simply don't participate in supporting, maintaining, and defending your fortress. Imagine your house of thoughts standing in the middle of an ocean of light. Imagine your awareness trapped inside the darkness of that house, struggling daily to live off of the artificial light of your limited experience. Now imagine the walls crumbling down and the effortless release of consciousness expanding into the brilliance of what is and always was. Now give that experience a name: enlightenment. Right? And that's the end of chapter 12. So, again, pay attention to how you limit yourself. Right? Pay attention to how you limit yourself. And that's the purpose of self-inquiry, whether using root cause inquiry, the Byron Katie's, the work, or another process. The purpose of self-inquiry is to help us get outside of that limited perspective of the psyche, to help us knock down those walls, to help us let go of defending ourselves with our own thinking, our own rationalizations, our own point of view. So that means I'm ready now to share the homework. Ken, of course, will put this in the post. But next week, we do start the review, by the way. And this review, I'm really excited about. Because I was really excited about the last 20 lessons. I think I kind of made it clear that I really thought the last 20 lessons were phenomenal. And in this review, we spend 20 days with the same 20 lessons. So it's not like the other reviews. The other reviews, we would do two lessons a day. This review, we get to spend time with only one lesson each day. So we're going to spend another 20 days with the same 20 lessons, which I think is fabulous. So this week, we'll begin the review starting tomorrow with workbook lesson 201, and we'll do seven lessons. So we'll do 201 through 207 this week. We'll also continue practicing daily meditation, either awareness watching awareness or the loving consciousness method, whichever you feel best with, for 15 to 20 minutes each day. And, of course, continue to practice that loving all method. That's a foundation for us. And in fact, today and yesterday, my tip talked about how we really we aren't pushing the world away. We're ignoring the world when we're in meditation, but when we're not pushing the world away. You know, we're really appreciating the world. We're appreciating it for the opportunities it offers us to heal, right? The opportunities to knock down our walls. And we're also appreciating it for the reflection of awareness, life, presence that we see in it, right? So we are, the loving all method, loving everything, is a part of our foundation. So continue to practice that. Homework assignment B. We're going to read The Most Direct Means to Eternal Bliss. We have a link so you can read this online. We're going to read from Chapter 7, but only sentences 10 to 52. Some of those other sentences talk about, you know, maybe meditating 12 hours a day or something like that, and that's not something that we're going to be doing right now. So I'm skipping those sentences. The sentences I want you to focus on in Chapter 7 are sentences 10 to 52. And then also read all of Chapter 8. So The Most Direct Means to Eternal Bliss, Chapter 7, sentences 10 to 52, and all of Chapter 8. And you have a link there, the albigen.com, And funny thing is, that link is not Michael Langford's. That link belongs to the TAT Foundation, which is really where Tess Hughes and Bob Ferguson are from. So what we have is the TAT Foundation, where Bob and Tess are from, recommending Michael Langford's teachings. So it's all kind of being tied up in a nice, neat bow for us. And then homework assignment C, we're going to watch a Rupert Spira video. It's called Meditation. Being aware of being aware is the highest meditation. And this can be found in the Gentle Healing playlist in YouTube. It's on the Awakening Together channel. But also, I'm sure Kim will put it right there in the homework. So workbook lessons 201 to 207, daily awareness, watching awareness, or loving consciousness meditation for 15 to 20 minutes a day. And, of course, the Loving All method. And then reading online, The Most Direct Means to Eternal Bliss. And if you have the book that has the numbered sentences, you could read from that book as well, the black book. But The Most Direct Means to Eternal Bliss, Chapter 7, sentences 10 to 52, and all of Chapter 8. And then watching Rupert Spira's Meditation, Being Aware of Being Aware is the Highest Meditation. So that's it. And I'm really excited that we get to go through these same 20 lessons again. So I will see you all next Tuesday, and enjoy your week. Bye-bye.